what? Oh, this is Brian. Call me the Mighty Rearranger Gardener, coming to you from the Devil's Hole, a.k.a. the Ramblon Towers Dungeon Studio in scenic Haspler, Ontario. You are listening to Ramblon Radio, the original Led Zeppelin podcast. Ramblon Radio is the original on this or any other known internets. I'm still not used to changing that. Be sure to go to ramblonradio.com for all your Led Zeppelin news, reviews, and any links I might mention during the show. You can subscribe to Ramblon Radio through iTunes. And if you're in iTunes, decided to pick up Carry Fire, the new Robert Plant album. Good for you. And while you're at it, stop by Ramblon Radio, leave a review, even if this is not how you get it. It helps Apple's algorithms find the podcast, which therefore helps other people find it. It rates it higher, regardless of what your review is. You can find us on find me on Podbean at I Am Brian Dammit. You can listen on Spreaker, and be sure to follow Ramblon Radio on Spreaker. And we're now on Stitcher Radio. Also, check out Ramblon Radio on YouTube, follow Ramblon Radio on Facebook, and at Ramblon Blog on Twitter. And I mentioned Podbean. It is a favorite podcatcher of the Android users. So be sure to download their app and follow and listen along on Podbean. So the intro music was Wearing and Tearing, Robert Plant with special guest Jimmy Page in 1990 at the Nebworth Festival in 1990. And Wearing and Tearing gets a little bit of discussion later on in this episode. We have a big, it's going to be a short for me, lots for somebody else. We have an interview, and it goes actually quite long. This podcast is going to run a little over an hour, I think. And it's going to be mostly interview. I'm going to be fairly quick here, and then we'll get to what I hope, what I think is actually a very good conversation, more as much as anything. The in history. What are we at? October 20th, 1976. Song Remains the Same film premiered in New York City. And that makes sense. I saw it in February 77. So yeah, fall of 76 makes sense to me. October 22nd, 1969. Led Zeppelin 2 was in fact released. In 2010, on the 22nd, Jimmy Page by Jimmy Page, the big book by Genesis Books sold out. It was the first run. It was $780 for that book. Of course, he later on made it available as a $40 book, not signed, not special paper, etc., etc., but not as a collector's edition. On the 23rd of October, 76, Led Zeppelin make U.S. TV debut on Don Kirshner's Rock Concert, and it's clips from the song remains the same. It's not actually Led Zeppelin, and I was actually read that quickly earlier this week and thought, God, I saw a lot of Don Kirshner's Rock Concert, and I never saw Led Zeppelin, but I may have seen the song remains the same clips, but, you know, it's just because I've seen the song remains the same so many times, it's something that gets blended in the memory. And the 23rd as well, in 2007, 10 years ago, Raising Sand. Alison Krauss and Robert Plant was released. And I kind of was going through some stuff recently. Actually, I was starting to sort out what am I going to do for 2018 on this podcast. And you go, first thing you do is go, what are the anniversaries, the, you know, tens and fives anniversaries. And I realized I missed Raising Sand this year. So I'm going to, I don't know if I'm going to ever get a chance to sneak in a talk about Raising Sand, and I think it's an important piece of work within the Robert Plant repertoire, as much as anything, because it's probably partly responsible, 50% responsible for there being no further activity after the O2 show. It certainly was a factor. So I would like to have looked back on everything around that. I might do that. I might sneak one in at the end of November, but there's a couple other things I discovered. I hadn't worried about that. I hadn't thought about that. There's, I think Coda is coming up too. Release of Coda. Maybe that was like 35 years ago, 25 years, 35 years ago. Anyway, 29th of October, 1968, Chris Drehav photographed Led Zeppelin for the first album cover. On the 2nd of November, 2007, 10 years ago again, the O2 reunion show was postponed. A infamous night in my house, I can assure you, as I ended up costing me about $800 then and there on the phone. And I had to do it just for changing our flight. And I had to do it that night, and my wife was steaming mad. And but I couldn't wait to decide or figure something else out, because the next day, the return flight would also have gone up by the same amount. So it was, you know, there was like this, you have 21 days to make the change. And we were inside the 21 day for the flight to England. The flight home was still outside, so we could change it without costing all this money. But we had one day to change. It was the next day it was going to go up. So it was probably the worst night of my married life. but hey, we're still here. Still talking about Led Zeppelin too. And on the 4th, 1969, more personal, well, not even personal, but, you know, my show, in a way, Kitchener, 1969 on the 4th. Now, I'm not old enough to have been there. It's just, Kitchener's just up the road. I can pretty much throw stones at the building they played in, which is still there, by the way. It's a hockey rink. Kitchener Rangers, a junior team, play there. So, if you're ever in the area, want to do some Led Zeppelin thingy, catch a Kitchener Rangers game. All right, so that's kind of all that stuff wrapped up, and so a quick talk about today's guest, Martin Popoff, is a heavy metal writer, primarily a rock, classic rock and heavy metal writer. He has done approximately 7,900 reviews. Record reviews, and his bio recommends that he has written more record reviews than anybody else in the history of music writing across all genres. He has written 57 books on hard rock, heavy metal, classic rock, and record collecting, including 2004's Contents Under Pressure, 30 Years of Rush at Home and Away, Rush the Illustrated History, Rush Album by Album. He has one on Yes. He has a book. He has a 4-book set on Thin Lizzy. Those two I'm particularly interested in grabbing copies of, and we'll be heading to martinpopov.com in the very near future to pick up copies of those. And you can head to martinpopov.com and pick up a copy of Led Zeppelin, all the albums, all the songs. I'm showing it to the microphone just so you cannot see it. It's a big hardcover book. It's available $30 US, $39 Canadian from martinpopoff.com. Probably available in your local bookstore. Probably available ebook style as well. Although I haven't had a chance to check that out. I will do so before the end of the podcast, because I got quite a long interview to stick in the middle anyway. And so I chatted with Martin on Wednesday of this week, Wednesday morning. He's actually a local guy, but we still talked over Skype. And we talked about, basically this book does album by album, well, what it says, album by album, song by song, all the albums, all the songs. Album by album, he just reviews. He reviews the albums, then he reviews song by song. Lots of tidbits in there. Probably for most of you, there's nothing extraordinarily new. I think it was one or two things. I didn't realize that. There's enough trivia tidbits in there that there's bound to be something you didn't quite realize. Lots of pictures. It's a beautiful book. Some beautiful, really neat pictures. Some really nice pictures. And it's not... it's not always... it's not always positive. How's that? He's a Led Zeppelin fan. But he's a heavy metal guy, primarily. And then the classic rock. And we discussed this very early in the thing. So he's coming at it from a very heavy metal approach often. Not always, but often. So he's looking at songs like Communication Breakdown and kind of talks about it as a heavy metal song. Whereas other guys, you know, the English guys specifically, Dave Lewis, I got his book right here. Chris Welch, I guess. I was thinking it was Charles Somethingworth. Chris Welch also has a similar book, and they kind of treat, you know, Communication Breakdown as a punk song, early punk song. very early, but he treats it as more as a heavy metal, early heavy metal song. So it's he comes at the stuff from a slightly different angle. Not always from the compliment. He's not fawning. He's honest, and that means some stuff is less favored for him, and he will say so. And another stuff he's quite, you know, he loves, and we talk long hard about what he loves. And you know, he had some really interesting observations. It's a good interview. It's a good chat. I really enjoyed talking to him. And I kind of hope he does another Led Zeppelin book so I can get him back on and talk to him again. Anyway, here he is. Martin Popoff. Good Canadian fella. Good Canadian boy. Author of, what did I say it was? 51 books? 57 books, including Led Zeppelin, all the albums, all the songs. Everybody should know you're a kind of a heavy metal guru, more than a rock guru, or is that right? Would that be fair to say?
I would say that'd be fair to say, but as time goes on and I get older, I become more of just a straight classic rock guy as my knowledge of current heavy metal starts falling away. I mean, we used to have a heavy metal magazine, and I would say around the year 2000 is when there were starting to be such an inundation of bands and styles that, you know, I started saying, you know what, I'm not an expert on this anymore. So I would say even more so now, I'm just more of an all-around classic rock guy.
Right. And I was going through your bio. You wrote books, four books, I think, on Thin Lizzy, plus Yes, you had a Yes book. Which,
yeah, and now there's been a Ramones book. There's a Pink Floyd book coming out soon, AC/DC. So what was the other prog or the other punk one? Maybe that's it. Oh yeah, a book on punk t-shirts. So definitely just a good variety. And you know, even most of the heavy metal hard rock stuff I've done is basically big bands from the 70s
right.
and 80s.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The material point would be that as you're looking at Led Zeppelin, you are looking at it from a heavy metal fan's perspective as much as anything. Again, fair to say?
Well, maybe a little bit. It is fair to say, I suppose that would be, you know, if I was to rank the ways I was looking at it, but maybe as a heavy metal fan, but also as a child of the 70s, as a drummer, as an acoustic fan, as an all-around Zeppelin fan, as a prog fan. But there might be a little, you know, for the very perceptive reader of this this new Led Zeppelin book, you know, you might pick up more kind of heavy metal comparisons and references. Sure. Yeah, I would say that's fair.
Yeah, and I just think it's a slightly different perspective. Like, you know, Dave Lewis comes at it, for instance, a similar subject from being a pure Led Zeppelin fan.
Yeah.
You're and a broader base on that heavy side of the band, I think.
Yeah, and he comes to it also, let's not forget, as the world-renowned Led Zeppelin expert,
yeah,
that's for sure, but also as a British person, you know, as someone who was there seeing all this, you know, on the ground floor seeing all this. I'm coming at it as a distant guy, as someone from Canada, right?
Yeah, and actually, that's interesting you mentioned that. I've talked to Dave a number of times, and I had to tell him one time, you know, in America, we didn't care that much about the punk. It didn't affect anything over here.
Right.
And he's actually, over the years, has toned down his, you know, in the Brits, they talk about how Zeppelin was, punk was overwhelming them, and I had to say that it didn't exist here. It was non-existent.
And you know, the idea that punk would overwhelm Led Zeppelin anywhere just seems farcical.
Yeah, it does.
It didn't overwhelm anything anywhere, but sure, it was definitely much more in the media over there. And yeah, I'm sure New York City and maybe a little bit in the cities in North America. But
yeah.
I mean, even me, like when punk was hitting, I was living in a small town in the middle of BC, Trail, BC. We weren't around any media centers. I mean, we were getting all our information from Cream and Circus and Hit Parader, and that's about it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I grew up in Brampton, so I knew one punk.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So they were an outlier.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so what I thought I'd do here is kind of go album by album, and pick one song or the album itself. Just talk about something you said in it, and try to, you know, keep the conversation flowing that way.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I've always been hesitant. I almost felt like warning you, like, let's not too much talk about, you know, too much inside baseball or specifics, because I find the interesting stuff that I've not gotten to talk about with this book is just the broader perspective. I mean, I'd like to hear your views on these albums as we go and just talk about our favorites.
Yeah, for sure. That's perfect. And so like I say, I picked one sort of subject on each, and hopefully it creates that conversation. Yeah. So we'll start with Communication Breakdown was the first one I kind of highlighted. You mentioned no one in Zeppelin wanted to take dibs on inventing heavy metal, but you felt Communication Breakdown was kind of a heavy metal song.
Yeah, I do. Quite strongly. I mean, basically, to me, you know, heavy metal really becomes invented proper with Black Sabbath's first album, February 1970, Deep Purple in Rock, Black Sabbath's second album. You know, these are, you know, I make an argument. I even have a book called Who Invented Heavy Metal, where all this is sort of talked about in great detail. But, you know, I almost feel like there's got to be a huge intention to invent heavy metal and sticking on it and staying with it. And Led Zeppelin, granted, didn't want to do that, and that's all the credit to them. That's fine. But Communication Breakdown is basically Paranoid before Paranoid happens. It's the staccato machine gun chugging guitar. It's punk rock. It's heavy metal. But it's there's just this idea of, you know, heavy metal is everybody crowds around the guitar riff of a song, right, almost like a campfire, and warms themselves off of the riff. And that's the type of song where it's really all about that guitar riff, and everybody else is almost like scampering to keep up, you know, from the drummer to the bass player to even Robert Plant. And so it's this fast, short, heavy song. You know, Robert Plant is also laying down the groundwork as the trademark heavy metal screecher and screamer. He looks like a heavy metal. The whole band looks like a heavy metal band. You know, certain bands can look like a heavy metal band and not be a heavy metal band. Black Oak Arkansas, REO Speedwagon, the Doobie Brothers. But Led Zeppelin definitely is almost like the template of that band that looks like the heavy metal band at the same time. So sure, I would definitely cop to that. I think Led Zeppelin should be proud of, you know, touching down in various places and being a landmark band and doing certain things, and that's a certain thing that they did. I think they're right in there on the ground floor inventing heavy metal, but really, you know, there are other bands who loved it more, and they're the ones who really should get the credit for inventing heavy metal.
Yeah, agreed. I did think it was interesting when we talk about the punk thing, the English guys consider Communication Breakdown the first punk song. Rather, you know.
Yeah, and that makes sense too. I mean, from a purely musical standpoint, it's absolutely right in there. But in all the aesthetic standpoints, Led Zeppelin is as far away from punk as you could imagine. And as the rest of the album proves, they were not, you know, down that road. Because by you know, 69, there were plenty of punks. You know, there was the Stooges' first album is 69, I believe. MC5 is recording Kick Out the Jams on New Year's Eve 68 and putting that out in 69. Blue Cheer is around. It's possibly a little more punky. Velvet Underground is around. Garage Rock has happened. So there's a lot more things that build the case for the invention of punk. But absolutely, I agree with you. On a pure musical standpoint, that's totally a punk rock song too.
Yeah. Okay, so moving to the second album. Anything else you want to say about the first album?
Well, let's see. You know, I do sort of have that feeling, a little bit of animosity towards it, that it is still still an old album. It's still a dated album. It is from the British blues boom. It's Led Zeppelin being the best band from the British blues boom, the most exciting band. But they aren't a new style of music. You know, I think, you know, that album gets credit for being a great album and having a great singer and some of these landmark, interesting, heavy things happening. But, you know, I really feel that we should also give a lot of credit for people who are out there inventing heavy metal and people who are out there inventing progressive rock at the same time. You know, Yes and King Crimson and Genesis, you know, these are as important records, you know, in the history of rock. So it's a little bit I find, you know, I hate this argument, but there is this debate that I have with people that who we talk about, is Led Zeppelin overrated? It's like, Yes, they are, because they are so highly rated.
That's right.
They can only be anything but overrated. They're either rated where they should be. They're certainly not underrated, because no one's rated higher.
That's right.
So in some forms, they are a little overrated. And I think Led Zeppelin's first album's a little overrated.
Yeah, and actually, you know, I almost highlighted for this album, the point you made was, and I didn't highlight it because I didn't want to start the interview on possibly a negative tone, you know? You mentioned that You Shook Me illustrates what was claustrophobic and restricted about the blues, British blues boom. And I agree 100% with that. It's just the blues song that a lot of other people were doing.
Yeah, and you know, I've interviewed, probably I wouldn't be exaggerating if I would say I've interviewed 1,600 different. I've done 1,600 interviews, but I would say at least a dozen people from that era, from the blues boom, from transitioning to heavy metal, said the blues boom was boring. You know, we left the British blues boom because it was boring our pants off. And Led Zeppelin obviously wasn't that bored with it because they kept doing it.
Yeah. And they crunched it out and did it as well as anybody, though, I think.
They did that as well as everybody, and then of course they were doing all sorts of things to move beyond it. But
yeah.
You know, they were a graduated grayscale as they moved along. Other bands, like I say, Black Sabbath, I think deserves more credit. Deep Purple in rock, these bands possibly deserve more credit for being more fearless and more exploratory, faster and on a more intense level.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So a whole lot of love. Move into the second album. You say, Plant's phrasing, vocal melody, the song is a frame for an early heavy metal song. And basically what you're saying there is Plant turns it into a blues song. It's really a heavy metal song, fairly straight up. Plant turns it into a blues song.
Yeah, that's interesting. And again, we can have a similar debate with Communication Breakdown, but this also brings up another interesting point. you know, I look at things like Allman Brothers' Whipping Post. There are certain things. This is basically the evolution of the blues into heavy metal, because there are certain blues touchstones, but then you get what Jimmy does with the riff there, and all of a sudden we've moved beyond that. And also, this song... you know, it's true. Robert is the guy anchoring it in the blues, but it also doesn't have a blues progression. And, you know, I have this, you know, you could write an essay on this or a book on this. I've said this at various times as well. But you can take early Kiss songs and Ted Nugent songs, and you could sit there with a little toggle switch, and you could go A, B, blues, heavy metal, blues, heavy metal, blues, heavy metal. And because you can hear, and what happens as the blues turns into heavy metal is you hear guys, it's funny, it's a really amusing thing to notice. You hear guys playing new hard rock sort of riffs, but when they're lazy about it, they go into little boogie little bits here or there as they're going along. And this is that A-B sort of idea. And Whole Lotta Love is definitely like that. It's basically, you know, really, really giving the blues some steroids and turning it into something brand new. And obviously, you know, Led Zeppelin is a case in point for literally taking old blues songs. And this is an example of that, where they're overhauling it and dragging it, kicking and screaming into the 70s. So, yeah, there's a lot of fascinating little subplots of a song like Whole Lotta Love.
And one of them I wanted to mention, you're a drummer, I understand, too.
Yeah.
Plant turns it into a blues song, and Page is fairly heavy metal. Bonham's shuffling in there, and he creates something that most heavy metal songs don't do in that side of things. He's, you know, he's off the beat a bit, and a shuffle.
I would maybe disagree with that a little bit. I wouldn't say it can be a shuffle because the riff is so rigid, but what he's doing is he's dropping beats and throwing beats in. He's basically doing a bit of a jagged 4/4 on there.
Right.
So it's a little different from a shuffle. You know, incidentally, off topic, I mean, Lee Kerslake and Uriah Heep are considered the kings of the shuffle, if you want to really hear shuffles done. And Foghat, for example,
right.
Roger Pearl, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, But, you know, all credit to John. I mean, he basically always finds interesting things to do, and this is why he's probably the most revered drummers by any drummer who picked up sticks in the you know, the following latter half of the 70s or the 80s. John is basically like everybody's hero.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's, yeah, he always kinds of find that one thing that, he can always swing to him a little bit, you know, he's...
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, you know, thinking about it a little more, it is apropos to use the word shuffle on Whole Lotta Love, because it is a shuffle. It's almost like it's a subconscious shuffle vibe, which is almost the same as having a swing vibe.
Yeah,
he swings. You're right. He swings more than he shuffles on that swing.
Yeah, I'm using shuffle merely to mean he's not hitting straight on the 2/4 all the time. You know, he's not anchoring the beat like, say, an AC/DC song where the drums are always right there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I liked you seem to like Out on the Tiles from the third album.
Yeah.
Always loved that song, and I always thought I was kind of one of the only guys.
Yeah, and 3 is my second favorite Led Zeppelin album, and my favorite Led Zeppelin song is Celebration Day. And I would put Out on the Tiles up there quite high, and I would also put Friends up there quite high. So I just love that album. You know, obviously it's the one that has, it shocked everybody with how much acoustic is on it or whatever. But Out on the Tiles is a super complicated, you know, proggy. Talk about John Bonham dropping beats. Well, everybody has to follow. Everybody has to do the same thing and know where these beats are being dropped or extra beats are being thrown in. I suppose that song would be classified a little more with extra things thrown in, keeping it off of the 4/4.
Yeah.
But I just love the way that that song has a kinship with Celebration Day, in that it's got a very sophisticated, non-obvious riff by Jimmy.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, it's just such a happy song. It's really a pop song at heart.
Yeah, but it's pretty heavy, and it definitely contrasts everything else on the album. It might even be the heaviest song. There's, I guess, the 3 songs, Celebration Day, that, and Immigration Song, which would be the 3 heaviest songs on it. But, but yeah, I just love the way that it's a, you know, without, you know, Zeppelin, the other great thing they can do is they can make the difficult sound effortless. And in that song, it to bring up what you were saying before, it swings, and it's not supposed to swing. It's just too mathematical to swing, and yet they make it swing.
Yeah, you're right. Much like Black Dog, right, where they...
They
just roll that through, and complicated as it is.
Yeah.
It's interesting from a drummer's perspective. You mentioned that only a drummer, or it sounds like a riff that only a drummer could instigate.
Yeah, and you know, I'm doing something on Alice Cooper right now, and thinking about Billion Dollar Babies and songs like that, where it almost seems propelled by the drums. And that one does sound like something that that basically everybody has to sort of keep up with the drummer on that one. Where in standard heavy metal, it's almost like, like I say before, the central thesis, or even indeed the most complicated part of the song, is usually the guitar riff, and everybody has to crowd around and sort of pay homage to that. But in that song, it's paying homage to the drum beat, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. And Zeppelin were one, Bonham really followed the guitar more than... more than a lot of drummers do. Would that be right?
Yeah, they do say that about Led Zeppelin, and it does kind of make sense. following is one word for it. Accenting, hitting some of the accents. Keith Moon was known to be that way as well, right?
Yeah.
You know, the Who's guitar work is usually not very complicated, but you know, when Pete would throw in a lick or an accent, Keith would be right there doing the same thing. And people often talk about Keith being lead drums, and I suppose Led Zeppelin, you know, both of those bands are essentially power trios. And in a power trio, you do get to lead a little more often than usual. So sure, John gets to lead.
Yeah, and you mentioned The Who. Pete Townsend talks in his autobiography about how... when he came up with the synthesizer stuff on Won't Get Fooled Again, he was worried about, because it was a programmed synthesizer, he was worried about Keith Moon following him, being able to stay with it, like a click track nowadays, of course.
Yeah.
And he brought it in, and Keith Moon had no problem. He says, and he realized at that point that Keith Moon had always followed him, that he had, Pete Townsend had always driven the rhythm. And yeah. Keith Moon was always following. Well, so it funny, wasn't a hard.
Any kind of click track could only help, anyways. It's yeah. it's hard. It's, you know, even if you're a crazy pants drummer, you're still going to be helped by a click track, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I guess because they didn't do click tracks in those days, right? So he was worried about the discipline that was going to be necessary for sticking with the synthesizer part.
Yeah.
And found Keith Moon had no problem whatsoever with it. Okay, so we mentioned Black Dog. Talk a bit about the rhythmic. It's a polyrhythmic song. Much like Kashmir, right?
Polyrhythmic, yeah. I suppose that is a term that could be used for it. Sometimes drummers talk about polyrhythms being they themselves are playing two rhythms at the same time. But in a sense, yeah, what happens is the riff carries on. It almost like ignores the idea of 4/4. And you're right, like Kashmir, it's interesting. Yeah, they both have that same sort of idea where it's almost like they are ignoring the idea of rhythm or structure, and the riff is going to go on as long as it is, and everybody's going to have to just like it or lump it. And end wherever anything wants to end. So that's why it's a confounding song to drummers,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's the old. What's the old musician story? We'll meet at the one, right? And
exactly. That's what they do. Yeah.
You play five, I'll play four, and we'll meet at the one.
Heads down, meet you at the end, as they say in the UK, for thrash or new wave of British heavy metal, right?
Yeah. So you said three was your second favorite album. What's your favorite?
Definitely Physical Graffiti. Okay. You know, I'm a sucker for double albums anyways, but you know, I've often said that's my favorite album. I don't know if you want to, do you want to talk about that now, or do you want to stay in order?
Let's talk about that. So I like Physical Graffiti is a great album all around, isn't it?
Yeah, I just think it's staggering in the amount of variety that's on it. It's pretty heavy. It's disciplined. You know, I find that even though it has a little bit of this idea of recordings being taken from disparate elements, I mean, all the records were like that anyways, maybe not so spread out in time as Physical Graffiti is, but personally, I think it sounds more, I think everything on there sounds pretty much uniform and the same. You know, super Zep heads tend to argue that point that, oh, this sounds so different from that song. But I remember getting it as a kid and never in my life thinking, you know, even for years, not even really recognizing or understanding that these songs came from different, you know, vastly different sessions or whatever. So to me, the record sounds very uniform. It's got a very conservative recording. It's not a noisy recording like some of the other ones. It's, you know, all the albums have sort of quirks to the recording. You know, we can all debate how much we like Led Zeppelin productions. But this particular one is one of the more correct and conservative ones with not a lot of noise. It's not got a lot of treble. It's not got a lot of bottom end. It's just a very kind of mid-rangey down the middle album, which is fine. But I love the, you know, the variety and the heavy metal on it and the epics on it and even how great the short songs are on it. But like I say, I'm a big sucker for double albums. But this one in particular is just so great. I mean, if they made a double album full of, you know, bluesy, jammy, hippie songs, like say the first two albums were combined into a double album, I wouldn't be saying that. But to me, this is Led Zeppelin taking a pretty cool modern leap into some really innovative structures. I think it's really cool. You know, I love Clash London Calling. That's another, which by the way, I've done another book exactly like this Led Zeppelin book where it's, you know, the Zeppelin book, of course, is talking about every single song, me, myself, and I, not interview stuff, right? It's just like analyzing every song. I did the exact same thing for The Clash, and that's coming out soon. It's probably going to have the same title, all the albums, all the songs. But, you know, I love double albums, and this is a great double album. But at the same time, sometimes I needle Zeppelin a little bit because I often think Black Sabbath Sabotage was my favorite album of all time. And sometimes I say, you know, what it took Zeppelin two albums to do, Sabbath honestly was able to be just as creative with one album. Sabotage, I'm not one of these guys who says Zeppelin is absolutely better than Sabbath. In fact, in most cases, I would be the guy arguing for Sabbath, championing Sabbath. And when it comes to 1975, yeah, I would say Sabotage is every bit as creative an album as Zeppelin is. And basically, they were able to do what Zeppelin did with one album.
That's not going to be a popular opinion here.
That's fine, but I mean, you look at The Ring, no. You look at Megalomania, you look at Thrill of It All, you look at Super Desire on that album. You know, you play that record, and it's basically, I mean, obviously it's half as long, so it's easy to say, oh, Zeppelin's better just based on, you know, finding bits that, oh, this is way cooler. But basically, I think Sabotage is as good as the best half of Physical Graffiti.
Well, I'll tell you, I just sat and wrote it down. I haven't listened to that in years and years and years. So I just sat and wrote it down as you were talking. So I'll have to listen to it with that thought in mind, with that ear in mind.
Put Megalomania is 11 minutes up against, In My Time of Dying, which is widely considered, you know, the classic, the greatest song on that, or Kashmir or whatever. And you'll see that, man, they're packing in a lot of action, lot of discipline, a lot of cool ideas, a lot of neat stuff going on here that's just as neat as anything on the Zeppelin. And it's actually probably, as an album, you know, you could also argue it's as much of a production tour de force. You take something like Super Czar or Am I Going Insane, or, you know, there's a lot of cool sound effects and production all over Sabotage. And I would argue that there's more than there is on Physical Graffiti. Although, like I say, you take Physical Graffiti, it's twice as long. You could find as much cool stuff, I'm sure, spread across that. But, you know, in terms of density and action, you know, Sabotage has as much.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, I'm gonna go back and listen to that. I want to step back just a bit. You talked about the consistency of the sound over Physical Graffiti. Kind of like yourself, I'm a guitar player.
Okay.
I've always kind of thought and talked about Page's guitar playing develops and matures very much. He starts using different voicings and I was the same as you. It never occurred to me that this was from different times. That the guitar playing sounds very consistent across this album.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like he's progressing through the years, but then you get to this album and stuff from 3 years ago still sounds like it was done on this album.
The way Jimmy is a genius more than anything is not particularly his guitar playing or anything. The way Jimmy's a genius is his songwriting, I think.
Yeah.
And this is full of amazing songs from start to finish and in just a daunting amount of variety. There's just such so cool. There's so many cool ideas and cool moods and quiet bits and loud bits. That's where Jimmy's a true genius, more so than guitar or indeed production. Production's a whole different kettle of fish we can talk about with Zeppelin, but I think the genius of Jimmy, you know, the part of his production acumen that is genius is possibly in his canny ability to keep things spare and let us hear everything perfectly and not be. You know, he's not a plush producer. I mean, he's a punk rock producer. Most of his productions have six or seven different punk rocky things about them, and not so much. You know, you like I say, compare it to, you know, Sabotage, for example. You know, which is still, it's a little bit of a raw album, but I mean, I don't compare it to Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon from 2 years earlier. You know, Jimmy is not that kind of producer. He's it's street, it's gritty. And even this one, being a clean Led Zeppelin album, is grittier than many big productions, even of the day.
Yeah, and producing wise, he's really just to kind of put the band in the room and let's go, and then a bit by the seat of his pants after that, isn't he?
Yeah, but we do know, you know, even from reading, you know, my book, which, you know, I can't profess these are not all my ideas. This is, you know, I'm synthesizing a lot of information that's been out there for a long time. But obviously a lot of the book is about picking this effect and this guitar and doing this with the keyboards and the things John Paul brings to it and stuff. So there are, you know, it's definitely more than that. There's some thought behind, there's a lot of thought behind things, but it all seems to be in service of the song, and he's very grounded about keeping things simple. And like I say, at the end of the day, Led Zeppelin's a power trio, and at the end of the day, they don't load things up so much that you don't think they're a power trio anymore.
Yeah, and I don't want to say when he keeps it simple that he doesn't do anything, but I guess my point, you say, what guitars are you using, what amps are you using? You know, all the thought goes into before the song.
And then
they just go, okay, now the song. And they're not bogging down the song with other stuff after the fact or during. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, great album. I just love it. Like I say, I mean, you know, various times in interviews or whatever in books when we talk about greatest albums of all time by anybody, I'm always oscillating between Sabotage, Physical Graffiti, maybe Queen One, and a few other things that are more quirky choices. But, you know, I try to reserve that very top clutch of five albums or whatever for albums that are, you know, conservative choices, things that people would choose that have obvious genius to them,
right,
and obvious like work put into them. Like, we can all talk about, does the Sex Pistols album belong up there or whatever, right? And there you're getting into abstracts and art and, you know, a little more of a discussion of abstract art versus the grand masters, right?
Right.
Or realism, or, you know, in perfect oil painting or whatever, right? So I try to keep those, that top five for albums that people think are in a realist realm, right?
Right, right. So we were talking about Jimmy's songwriting there. When they did the reissues recently, we got the fully instrumental version of The Song Remains the Same, which is a great example of his songwriting, how he crafts a song. I mean, that's an almost orchestral piece in a way.
Yeah, and it's a really loopy, cool, non-obvious song. Everything about that is cool. And you know, as we were talking about Art on the Tiles and Celebration Day, I think here you got another very sophisticated, strange riff.
Yeah.
And, you know, his riffs can be so sophisticated and strange that you don't even really call them riffs. I mean, they're more like, in this case, it's more like chord structure than riffing. You know, riffing is something that people who look down their nose at heavy metal, like Led Zeppelin, would probably say belongs in heavy metal, or it's more of a characteristic of heavy metal. You know, you might argue that it's even more sophisticated when you can't even tell if it's a riff or not.
That's
you know,
right.
Texture and chord structure and alternate tunings mixed with the idea of riff makes some of the more sophisticated things that you can do on a guitar, and I suppose Song Remains the Same is one of those. It's just a very, very sophisticated, strange song.
Yeah, and I always thought about Song Remains the Same, considering how sophisticated a song it is, and then Robert Plant come along and goes, oh, I should add words to that. A lot of guys, the words would have been awful or it would have really taken away, but he didn't. He added to the song, I think.
Yeah, I think words always add to the song. I'm not a big guy for instrumental albums at all. I think they're 40% of a real album when something's instrumental. I just do not like instrumentals. I'm a lyric guy. I'm a literary guy. I love words. I love lyrics. I love singing. To me, a song's not even a song until it's got lyrics on it. So he could have done anything on that to make it better for me. but yeah, boy, strange, you know. Writing this book made me really think about Robert's lyrics. I always put him down as a lyricist, but I actually got a newfound admiration for his lyrics. They can be sparse, they can be simple and spare, and the ones we seem to always remember are the ones that are dull. or come from a blues tradition or whatever. But he throws out a lot of lines where you really got to sit back and say, wow, that was really cool what he said there. Yeah. And they're often, you know, in what we remember in our brains about Led Zeppelin, they just often seem to be throwaway things. But you add it all up and then you see and maybe do a little research into what he was getting at. You know, he's always very inscrutable. And he doesn't really want to talk about what he's getting at. But when he does let on or where you can figure out what he's getting at, it's often pretty darn interesting.
Yeah, I actually agree, especially later on. He gets better and better as he goes, I think.
And he's rock and roll. I mean, that's one of the complaints about Zeppelin, and sometimes is that they're too rock and roll, they're too loose and too casual.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, and when you say he gets better as he goes along, it's like, you know, I think early on, when you have that blues ethic, you know, part of you is just saying, I don't want to take this too seriously. I just, you know, we're a rock and roll band. Let's all be rock and roll. And I think Led Zeppelin was almost too rock and roll at times early on.
Right, right. I'm going to jump the In Through the Outdoor.
Is it?
I didn't mark this down. Did you mention at some point that Page's guitar playing is very, very professional?
Possibly. I mean, I do believe that. I really find him incredibly sophisticated on that album. Now, obviously, you know, that the narrative at this time is a little more that it's a John Paul Jones album and Jimmy is a little bit absent due to heroin abuse or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, you know, Jimmy, as time goes on, he just becomes more of this signature guy that we associate with Jimmy. I mean, so much of that album is the Jimmy of the Firm almost. It's a little bit of Jimmy of the presence. But I almost feel that the Jimmy that we hear, even on Outrider and on the two Firm albums, not so much on Walking into Clarksdale or Death Wish or anything like that, but I think I almost link his playing on In Through the Outdoor with the two Firm albums more than anything. It's just a very – he becomes even more of a personality that nobody is like whatsoever. Yeah. On that record. I just find it to be, you know, there's a clutch of guitarists, maybe a dozen or so, that you say totally have their own style. Jimmy, along the years leading up to In Through the Outdoor, has certain things where you say that's a real Jimmy style, and it's more so in possibly a little bit in the acoustic playing, possibly in the guitar soloing. But I think this is where I almost feel like the riffing that you hear on Physical Graffiti is so different song to song that I don't think you could say there's a Jimmy style there. But I think just that the style that you hear in his rhythm playing on In Through the Outdoor is like that. That is the most characteristic thing that you can even say about Jimmy Page.
Yeah, and I brought it up because it's something I've said before too, and it's like he showed up to the sessions and everybody else did the writing, and his old studio days just naturally kicked in, and he's okay, I'll add something here. And some very tasty guitar playing. And all my love, some of those little licks are just so lovely.
Yeah, and the production of that album, you know, again, like every single Zeppelin production, it's not great. There are certain ways, there's certain objective ways you can say that this is kind of crappy in certain ways. But then, you know, the funny thing about Zeppelin is they're such a magical band that it's the weirdest thing where people think the productions are genius and they're some of the greatest of all time, and then people say they're the crappiest of all time. Yeah. I mean, what kind of magical band are you where you go from 0 to 100 on the gradation scale of smart people saying the productions are crap and the productions are the greatest of all time? That is amazing to me, right?
Yeah.
And you can get into the whole thing about how certain productions sound great on AM radio or FM radio or on a good stereo, and then you can have that talk with Led Zeppelin, right?
Right.
Because that's a big thing in the 70s, writing for not great stereo systems, right?
That's right.
And people and Zeppelin. I mean, there's not a lot of talk about Led Zeppelin and that topic. That'd be an interesting topic to write something on with Led Zeppelin. But anyway, so In Through the Outdoor to me, I love its big, fat, warm production. But again, like all Led Zeppelin albums, it's lacking on treble. Except, you know, when Led Zeppelin gives you treble, they give you distorted treble, unfortunately. But it's lacking on treble. The bottom end it's a very sophisticated bottom end, but I love the way that the three categories of the mid-range, perhaps, low mid-range, mid-mid-range, and high mid-range, very sophisticated on that record.
Right.
So I love the production of that record. In fact, I would say it's my favorite produced Led Zeppelin album.
Oh, yeah. I'm a huge fan of it. Now, it's either loved or hated, of course. More than most, I think, Led Zeppelin albums. But
that album, yeah. Well, and that's more so because it's not very heavy, right?
Yeah.
People really didn't like the fact that it was not a very heavy album. And, you know, it has more keyboards and stuff on it. But people also, obviously, Led Zeppelin heads, they complain about Hot Dog. Yeah. They complain about All My Love, really, being a little bit too saccharine and structured as basically too obvious a ballad. You know, Led Zeppelin, when they were mellow, they would be proggy, or they would have sophisticated folk things going on, or maybe they would have things that, you know, lead to a tried and true kind of blues pedigree or whatever. But All My Love's got a little bit too much of just, it's just a little bit too much of a wedding song. So there are things to complain about on that album. And then of course, when you don't have enough songs on the album, they're long songs. And you complain about a couple, all of a sudden there's only five left or something, right? that you could say that you like, right?
Yeah.
So, and even In the Evening is like, In the Evening's like, you know, it's actually one of the heavier songs on the album, but that chord pattern is pretty boring. It's pretty lazy, right?
Right.
Not much goes on in that chord pattern. But of course, you know, they're sophisticated. Ear candy happening. There's changes, sophisticated changes, but you know, just to go, nah, 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 you know, it gets a little dull, right?
Yeah.
So, but you know, and I was, you know, me, angry metalhead in 1979. You know, where all we liked was the heavy albums and heavy songs by all our bands. Led Zeppelin was certainly not one of my favorite bands in the 70s because they were just not heavy enough, right? So when that album came on, I remember hearing it on Creme FM out of Spokane. They played the entire album, and we were horrified. You know, it was just way too mellow for us at the time.
Now I was the opposite.
But now it's, you know, it's certainly my top, it's in my top three. It'd be probably my third or even close to second favorite Led Zeppelin album.
I was the opposite. I was 16 in 79, and I was a Zeppelin geek.
Right.
And I loved this album from the get-go. Mm. It's kind of my Led Zeppelin album, you know. And I do think there's the love it, hate it. There's a bit of an age gap there. The older Led Zeppelin fans hate it.
Right.
The younger ones being me, he's only 54 now.
Yeah.
You know, we're, because it was in our wheelhouse time.
Well, I'm 54 too. And you know, my wheelhouse time, I would say, is 76, 77. Like, I was a crazy music fan, an expert by 13 years old, right?
Right.
So, I mean, my favorite bands were Aerosmith, Kiss, Ted Nugent, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple a little bit, Blue Oyster Cult. All the heavy bands, right?
Yeah.
So Led Zeppelin was always this band who's never giving us enough of what we wanted as kids, right?
Right.
So 79, you know, I was exact same age as you, obviously. 79's a very interesting year. I almost want to write a book on 1979 because that was the year when, and I do mention, I think, a little bit about this in the Led Zeppelin book. It was the year when it was a down year for the economy. It was a down year for the music industry. The music industry was fighting disco. You know, the sort of age-old thing. I don't know if this is an age-old thing, but I keep saying it, so it's becoming a cliche. But, you know, the idea that In Through the Outdoor, The Eagles' Long Run, and Pink Floyd, The Wall were supposed to be the albums that were going to save the industry. But at the same time, you had The Cars and The Knack as well doing well. So you had Skinny Tiny Wave doing well. So there was a little bit of, like, clearing out the dinosaurs. But I remember what was happening at the time. was that certain bands, the heavy bands, were letting us down. Deep Purple was gone. Led Zeppelin was making a mellow album. Aerosmith was busting up. Ted Nugent was starting to go south. Blue Oyster Cult was turning in their most mellow album. Kiss was doing Unmasked and Dynasty. So it was a funny time. But I guess to wrap this up in a big red bow, Led Zeppelin fit that frustration we had with 1979 as kids, because here they were turning in a mellow album for us and we were not happy.
Yeah, and actually it's something I thought of as I was reading this book, and I thought before, going back to 76, 77, that's Presence is a very dark, trudgy kind of album, and that kind of feels like it has always felt to me like it of the mood of the it's an of the time album. Darkness on the Edge of Town would be another one that's like that from the same year.
Right. Yeah. Presence. Presence. I've always had a bit of a problem with as well, because I found it to be, it's almost like it's got the sophistication of the writing of Physical Graffiti, but it's got the casual playing and the casual production of the early albums.
Yeah.
So it's almost like it's got like a four vibe to it, but it's got the writing of Physical Graffiti.
Yeah.
So it's almost like with a really sort of like nailed down conservative production, it could almost sound like the, you know, a better follow up to Physical Graffiti. But, you know, at the time, you know, I guess we kind of liked that it was fairly heavy, but it just wasn't, you know, basically at the time, again, you know, I hate putting down Zeppelin all the time, but I just got to tell it like it is. You know, at the time, the big album for us was Rainbow Rising. I mean, that record was, yeah. It sounded like Led Zeppelin #1, but it sounded like, it only had six songs on it, and all six of them were like All Cashmeres and In My Time of Dying and Achilles Last Stand done better than Achilles Last Stand. Like, that album was start to finish heavy. It was the first album we ever heard as kids where we had this crazy rating system. I won't go into it, but it was the first album we had as kids where every single song was heavy.
Right.
And the other ones at the time were the Sex Pistols album in 77 and AC/DC Let There Be Rock in 77. But basically, Rainbow Rising, you put that up in 1976 up against Presence, and Presence is like a wilting flower in every department. Again, like we were talking about fighting words, you know, between Sabotage and Physical Graffiti. Boy, you put up Rising against Presence, and Presence just sounds like a tired band falling into retirement.
Yeah, Presence was not a loved album at the time. I would concur fully with that. Yeah,
the press. You're right. The press was getting down on Zeppelin because it was the time that they were massive. They were gods, but they were also dinosaurs to be knocked down by punk, and the press fell into that a little bit. And Zeppelin fed it by turning in an album that did feel a little bit like a little bit too rock and roll again, right? You know, it wasn't up to the standards of Aerosmith Rocks. I mean, imagine Aerosmith Rocks in 1976. Yeah. You put that up against Presence, and it's like clearly one of these bands is being professional about making records, and one of them isn't. Right?
Yeah.
It's just so obvious. You know, you listen to that album, you know, just bloom into view with Sick as a Dog and that acoustic guitar layered over that absolutely high fidelity headphone quality production and those beautiful, harmony vocals and this incredible riff that's as good as any Jimmy Page riff, the Sick as a Dog riff, right?
Right.
So all of a sudden, within a minute and a half of Sick as a Dog, they've done everything Led Zeppelin has already accomplished, but better.
Right.
And you put that up against Presence, and, you know, if I may draw another comparison, you know, we always felt at the time, and I do say this in the book, that Achilles' Last Stand almost seemed like Led Zeppelin trying to force their way into the heavy metal market.
Right.
You know, something they've always denigrated. And it's funny, it's like, they're trying to force their way into the heavy metal market. And then the next year, Aerosmith puts Kings and Queens on Draw the Line. And that almost felt like Aerosmith trying to force their way into the Rainbow and Led Zeppelin market.
Right.
Not the blues market, but the epic market, right?
Yeah.
So Kings and Queens, I remember we always put down Kings and Queens as being a forced heavy metal song that Aerosmith, no, they're bluesy rock and roll heavy metal band. They're not in this epic realm. the same way we put down Led Zeppelin for doing Achilles, which they're trying to force their way into this heavy metal thing. And of course, we always compared the two albums because they're both white, and you know, the album cover, and also Aerosmith was in a way, or Draw the Line was in a way Led Zeppelin's or Aerosmith's presence. It was them being a little bit tired.
Yeah.
After Rocks, so Rocks to Draw the Line. There's a through line of Physical Graffiti through Presence. But I'm rambling.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I'm actually going to go to something you said fairly early on there about it being a throwback album. In a way, you're right. It's like the second album. It was recorded almost like a road album, but without the benefit of the tightness of a road band.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It does sound like a road album. But you know, that's some of its charms as well. I mean, there are some great music on there. And again, it is funny. It is Led Zeppelin trying to do the Led Zeppelin that Aerosmith copied in a way. Yeah. It's the trying to put the sophisticated riffs on songs that have a little bit of Stones blues boom swagger. And so Led Zeppelin does a little bit of that on Presence, not on Achilles, but on much of the rest of Presence, I suppose.
Yeah, and I have to confess, Presence has really grown in my estimation through the years. I've grown to love it. Maybe because I didn't listen to it so much back then, so now it's...
You know, that's the key point right there. For Led Zeppelin heads, right, Presence is that dark hole album that you never really... you never really burned out on because the songs weren't the big ones that were on radio so much. Yeah. So for a deep Led Zeppelin head, it's the album that you can kind of go back to, and at least it still feels a little fresh to you. Still.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and so we'll wrap up with Coda. Now, I was reading your all through your Coda, the stuff you were saying, and I kept coming to an idea that you didn't actually say, but I think was kind of there in the background. That is that, as he was assembling Coda, Page wasn't looking for the best songs in the repertoire. He wasn't looking for the most complete songs they had. He was looking for the John Bonham songs that they had, the best John Bonham examples. This is really a tribute to John Bonham more than what they say is a wrap-up of Led Zeppelin's career.
Well, that's a really interesting idea. I don't think it's an idea I made. You're saying that's an idea you've come up with.
Yeah,
right?
But I was... Yeah. You said that's a couple of things that it made me go... And actually, my thought was it seemed like you were playing with that idea in the book without coming up... You know what I mean? You know how you write your way through some thought processes? It felt like you were doing that in the Coda section.
Well, but the elephant in the room, of course, is that... The bottom line is these are the only Led Zeppelin songs. Besides what's on Coda, there's only like three or four more, right? If that.
Yeah.
There's Traveling River Blues or whatever it's called, and Hey Hey My My, and then, or Hey Hey, whatever it's called, and the fragments of things they put across the reissues. These are the only songs,
but,
right?
Except that what was it? Like there was one where they brought in the band and Robert Plant did add lyrics, and was that Poor Tom? Did they do that or Walter's Walk?
Yeah. There's a little bit of fakery, of course. Yeah, mm-hmm. We know about that. The vocals were put on a little bit later, right?
Yeah.
Because it's Robert from the essentially the debut album of Robert's solo thing, right? But
right.
It's interesting to get back to the John Bonham. You're right. He shines all over this album. That's for sure. I mean, granted, like I say, these are the only songs. He had no choice. There were no more songs. But it is interesting that they are mostly songs that John totally shines on. There's a John drum solo. He shines on Poor Tom, which otherwise would be just a folk song. But it turns into a drumming song, which is, you know, another just cool thing Zeppelin did, they gave us. But the thing I love about Coda more than anything is that, it's three songs, right, that could have been on In Through the Outdoor. I think it's three, right?
Yeah.
And they all would have been the three heaviest songs on In Through the Outdoor. That is so cool to me. So it's nice to conjecture about how In Through the Outdoor could have been quite a bit of a heavier album if they swapped out Hot Dog and All My Love, say, for example, and then threw in these three, right?
Right.
Nobody would have been complaining about In Through the Outdoor if they had done that. It would have been a pretty heavy album, which is kind of cool. And also that the super old song on there, what is
We're Gonna Groove?
Sorry, what was that?
We're Gonna Groove?
Well, that one as well, but Walter's Walk is the other
okay,
one.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's Walter's Walk is the other. Okay. Or is that the heavy newer one?
No.
Which is it? Walter's Walk or Wearing and Tearing? One of those is an old heavy one.
Yeah, right? No, Wearing and Tearing is from the later sessions.
Okay, so Walter's Walk is an old super heavy song, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
That you know, we got Walter's Walk. So you got Walter's Walk is the old heavy song. We're Gonna Groove is an even older heavy song. And Wearing and Tearing is the new, which would have been the heaviest song in Through the Outdoor. And Darlene and Ozone Baby are both guitar songs.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. So Coda's a great album. I just wish, you know, one slight wish with Coda is throw on the last three or four things and make it like a longer album. I don't like the fact that I think it's only 8 songs, right?
Yeah.
And one of them is just a retread of... Yeah, I Can't Quit You Baby's on there. That's just right. A retread. And there's a guitar and there's a drum solo. So you got 8 songs. One of them's an old blues that we've heard before. And one of them is a drum solo. So I think it would have been kind of cool if they would have pumped it up to 10 songs.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were certainly a couple of songs there they could have thrown in.
Yeah. No, but even they have, you know, compromised histories because they're already released. They're already B-sides and stuff, right? But, you know, I can't think of them off the top of my head, but if you grab all the reissues, there were a couple other things. What, Sugar Mama, right?
Yeah, and what was the,
that
the one?
Been there. What's that?
There's one they did in the same session as Hats Off to Roy Harper.
Was it an original or a cover? Because
it was a cover. It was an old blues song.
It's an old blues song?
Yeah, an old acoustic blues.
So that's compromised in a way as well. So so obviously, you know, yeah, Sugar Mama would have probably been the best thing to put on there, but also, you know, the B-sides and maybe another old blues song. Or even, you know, you even could have thrown on one of those, reissue album things that was a little bit more of a radical thing with like one of these crazy alternate mixes or something.
Yeah.
Right? I remember... is it Immigrant Song? There's some really cool stuff going on with vocals that he did on one of the reissues, right. I think, on that. So, it could have been better. But, I mean, I just love the fact that I just love Darlene and Ozone Baby and Wearing and Tearing specifically. And even We're Gonna Groove and Walter's Walk. I mean, that's more than half the album.
Yeah.
And I just love all those songs.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, going back a bit... Darlene and Wearing and Tearing, they were supposed to do a 45 of that they were going to release.
Right, there was
Nebworth.
That whole thing with they were going to do something for Nebworth or just for the UK or for one of the magazines, right?
Yeah, I think that's probably why it didn't make it onto In Through the Outdoor. I think that's what they were probably thinking there, that, oh, we'll supplement with this. And then of course, things don't happen in real time with Led Zeppelin. They happen in... Led Zeppelin time, as John Paul Jones once called it. But, yeah.
Yeah.
And it didn't get done.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're well into it here. We're an hour in, so that's time to wrap it up.
Cool.
Tell everybody your website and where they can get your books.
Yeah, so I have www.martinpopoff.com. Basically, a large part of my business is buying and selling my own books, and plus I do a lot of self-published books that are only available there, so I've got 75 books. And I'd say 40 of them are available from my site. The Led Zeppelin is available from my site. I sign them all. I ship them off. Good savings to be had if you find a few other things you want to get at the same time. But yeah, I would say out of the 35, 40 books I have at my site available, I would say more than half of those are only available at the site. So yeah, check out martinpopoff.com. There's PayPal buy now buttons for America, overseas, Canada, and I sign them all and send them out. Glad to do it.
Perfect. And the book is called Led Zeppelin, All the Albums, All the Songs by Martin Popoff. It's fabulous. Thanks for coming on, Martin.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. This has been very cool.
Good. Glad you enjoyed.
Cool.
All right.
We'll talk to you later.
We'll see
you. See ya. Yeah, bye.
Bye. And that was Martin Popoff. Again, good Canadian boy, up the road from me in Toronto. And as noted, 57 books he's written. He's also involved in, if you saw the Rush Beyond the Lighted Stage video, we were talking about it before the interview, the actual interview, and he was, for a year and a half, he was heavily involved in that. That would be the Big Rush documentary from about 5 or 7 years ago. He's also been involved in Rock Icons, a 10-episode TV show, 11-episode Metal Evolution, both of them for VH1 Classics. And he's written for magazines, Guitar World, Gold Mine, Record Collector, that sort of thing, Hard Radio. He's been an editor-in-chief of Brave Worlds and Bloody Knuckles, Canada's foremost heavy metal publication. So he's kind of done it all as a writer, and now he's done Led Zeppelin as well. And my thanks to Martin Popoff. Go to martinpopoff.com. Go through so many books. There's going to be something that interests you. Get something for your Christmas list. Certainly when I do my Christmas episode, Christmas list episode, this book will be on it. I really enjoyed it. And although, you know, it's reviews of songs and whatnot, it's not a history of the band. If that's more your thing, this may not be your bag, this book, but it's, yeah, I enjoyed it. It was an entertaining look at all the songs, and it was at times thoughtful look. You know, he approached them from a different perspective. Listen, I'm going on. The next episode, I'm planning on giving it a more full review when I have time. So let's do that. Let's save that. We'll talk about that book next episode. So that's it. Ramble on Radio, episode 135. Check rambleonradio.com for notes on this week's podcast, Led Zeppelin news and reviews, and any links I mentioned in today's podcast. Follow Ramble on Radio, and I'll certainly link to Martin's website in the next day or two. Follow Ramble on Radio on Facebook, at Ramble on Blog on Twitter. You can subscribe to Ramble on Radio through iTunes. If you go to iTunes, leave a review. It helps other people find us. You can listen on Stitcher Radio and Spreaker, and be sure to follow Ramble on Radio Spreaker, or you can download it from I Am Brian Dammit on Podbean. And if you're on Android device, Podbean is the podcatcher of choice for a lot of people. If you're on an Android device listening to this podcast or other podcasts, by the way, and you're using a podcatcher, a platform that I'm not mentioning, please let me know so I can verify that you can download it from that or make sure that it's possible. So also on, check us out on Ramble on Radio on YouTube. And I have to start, in the new year, one of the things I'm going to do is start re-YouTubing these because I've had some requests for that. Some people actually want to check out the podcast via YouTube. So I'll be looking into that in the new year. Thanks for listening to Ramble on Radio, episode 135, and we're going to outro with the rest of Wearing and Tearing from 1990 Nebworth Festival. Robert Plant and his band featuring special guest Jimmy Page. You know you say you're feeling blue, but I just found a cure. It's the thing that you got to do. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Your body's aching, I know your body's aching. Too much can my body. Too much better fooling. Yeah, just a better fooling. Just like fooling at the school. You ask for medication. Who cares for medication? When you're throwing away the cure. Yeah!
He's got in his pocket for you. Yeah.